All right, Romans 2. We're going to pick up where we left off. I'll give you a little bit of brief background to kind of catch us up, and you're going to see today why all those, however many weeks we spent, what did we spend? 6 weeks? 7 weeks? Do we know? However many it was, studying Hebrew history is going to come into play. You're going to understand a lot more of Paul's argument now as a result of all that. Every commentator who's writing on the Bible at all admits that Romans 2:17 all the way through Romans 3:20 is one of the most difficult passages in the Bible. Everybody admits that it's a difficult passage to get a grip on. It's why we needed all this background. It's why I took all these weeks of Hebrew history before we went to it, is that Paul is going to take on a certain writing style here, a certain writing character. It takes some work to decipher what it is he's saying. He's going into a true diatribe. The Romans, who he's writing to right here, I told you they're both Jews and Gentiles, and all Jews and Gentiles, all Romans, anybody living in Roman culture was very, very influenced by Greek culture. I don't know if you know that the Romans historically were always just kind of barbarians. They didn't have a great deal of culture of their own. They didn't have a lot of education of their own. They didn't have a whole lot of societal, they were a very earthy people. And when they conquered the Greeks, they inculcated Greek culture, and hence the term Greco-Roman culture. If you read history at all about Rome and about Middle Europe during that period, you'll see the phrase Greco-Roman a lot. And it's because it really was an amalgam of Greek culture and Roman culture. It was Rome who ruled the whole area, but the culture at large was Greek culture. The pantheon of Roman gods was very influenced by the pantheon of Greek gods. Roman education was really Greek education. The Greeks were in search of the perfect man. The Greeks wanted to have the perfect physical, mental, spiritual person, which is why when you go back and you look at all the Roman art and sculptures of that day, you always see the perfectly well-built, muscular guy either heaving a javelin or throwing a discus. It's why the Olympics come from Greece. It's why we still have Greco-Roman games to this day. It all started back there in their pursuit of the perfect man. So in their pursuit of intellectual debate, they had certain rules of debate that we use even up till today. Brent probably in his college education, university education, spent some time in debate, and you've probably come across diatribe. Well, diatribe was a form of argument that Greek philosophers would use. And the way a diatribe worked would be that there would be a student and a master. The student was only allowed to ask questions, and the master would answer the questions. But a true diatribe, an educational diatribe, the master himself would pose the questions that he assumed the student would ask before the student asked them. And Paul does a lot of that in the book of Romans, where he poses the question he assumes you're going to ask. This next section, he's going to do that. He's creating a polemic. A true Greek polemic is an argument that goes from like point to point to point to point to drive you into a corner where you ultimately are forced to come to a conclusion. Now, the people he's writing to recognize this form, and they understood that the questions he was asking here are rhetorical questions. In other words, he's assuming an answer. He's going to ask questions and then just leave the question hanging there. And depending on what you assume the answer will be, that's the way you're going to interpret Paul's point. This is what's complicated about it. Much of what he's going to say and ask here is predicated on your understanding of Hebrew history and Greek culture, and where the Greeks are today, where the believing Jews are, where the believing Romans are, where the believing Greeks are in Rome at this point in history, is the basis of a lot of his questions. So we're going to kind of have to plow through this kind of slowly, and I'm going to tell you what he's basing his question on and what the assumed answer is, and you'll find out that it's really not that tough if you look at it in the whole context. What we need to recall from chapter 2 this far is that chapter 2 began, well, chapter 1 was all about Paul saying that all people are guilty. It didn't matter if you did or did not have the law. It didn't matter if you did or did not have the Word of God, that there was enough in the creation of the world to prove that God exists. And if you have the proof that God exists, you're going to be held guilty for the fact that God has already made his existence obvious. Remember that? Everybody will stand guilty before God on the basis of the fact that God exists and he's proved he exists. As a consequence, then, he knows that when he wrote these things and said these things and talked about the people who had no law and who had no word of God and who were the heathen, he knows, he assumes that the Jews then are going, oh, well, he doesn't mean us. Oh, well, we have circumcision and we have the law of Moses. So he clearly doesn't mean us. He's talking about those heathen out there. He's talking about the Gentiles out there. He's talking about those people who don't have the advantages we've had. So now Paul is going to turn the tables on them. And for the next half a chapter, in the first half of chapter 3, he's going to turn it on the Jews and say, you're every bit as guilty. Because by the time he gets done, he's going to make sure that everybody is convicted. That's the standpoint. Now, what you also have to know is, we've studied over the last several weeks circumcision and the law. Circumcision was the token of the Abrahamic covenant. So everyone who was a descendant of Abraham would be circumcised, every male. But then, when the law came, it was given to those exact same people who were circumcised. The circumcised people became Israel. Israel was then given the law. So the two things that identified an Israelite was that they were circumcised and they had the law. So those two things by the first century had become very synonymous. If you were a Jew, if you were circumcised, you kept the law. If you kept the law, you were circumcised. The two were completely synonymous. There was nobody who was not circumcised and trying to keep the law of Israel. That's pointless. These two were almost interchangeable. Paul writes a lot about people in Galatians who were circumcised and uncircumcised. And when he said that, he said, if you're circumcised, you're required to keep the whole law. If you were going to approach God on the basis of Israelitish justification. I'm trying to get you into that first century mindset. I'm trying to get you to think the way a Greco-Roman Jew would be thinking at that moment. So starting at like verse 11, actually starting at like verse 9 of chapter 2, starting about verse 9, he's made the point. He's divided everybody into two groups, obedient people and contentious people. And he said, obedient people will be rewarded, contentious people will be punished. And then he said to the Jew first and also to the Gentile for the first time in verse 9. So to a Jew, they would sit up and take notice and go, hold it. What do you mean to the Jew first and also to the Gentile? You've just equated the Jews and the Gentiles. And you have said that we will be rewarded or punished on the basis of our reaction to God's word. Now, wait a minute. Paul broke down that middle wall of partition that would have said Jews over here, Gentiles over here, and said you will both be held accountable before God. To a Gentile, that was a radical notion. They believed, by the first century, they were completely convinced, and you see it in the writings, extra-biblical writings. You can go back and read the writings of the rabbis of the day, the rabbinical tradition. They believed that if you were circumcised, just physically circumcised, that would keep you from the wrath of God. All you needed was to circumcise your kid when he was a kid, and that kid could never undergo the wrath of God because he was a covenant child under the covenant of Abraham and thereby saved. So when Paul said to the Jew first, he was saying, you circumcised people who are under the impression that God cannot ever pour his wrath out or judge you, he said right here, he will pour out tribulation and anguish upon every soul of man that does evil, of the Jew first and also of the Gentile. Well, that was an absolutely radical notion to them. Wait a minute, Paul, you're flying in the face of our tradition. And in verse 10, when he said, but glory and honor and peace to every man that works good, he then said to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. So he drew this equation between the Jews and the Gentiles, where it was much more than just having the word, much more than just being circumcised. You actually had to live out what you claim to believe. And now with all the Jewish history we've seen, you can enter into why the Jews were so upset by that comment. Why? Verse 11, because God is no respecter of persons. God doesn't care. Jew, Gentile, don't care. With or without the law, don't care. With or without circumcision, don't care. God will judge every man according to his deeds. Now, let me also say, by the way, pause there for a moment because I can hear your theological brain clicking. When I say, and when Paul says, every man will be judged according to his deeds, He has not yet given them the good news. He's saying every man will be judged according to his works, to his deeds, to his actions, to his righteousness, so that he can convict everybody and say there's none righteous, and then he'll get to the good news of Christ. So even though I just said every man will be judged according to his needs, I heard some of you, Brent in particular, say in your head, but wait a minute, I won't be judged for my deeds because I'm a Christian and my deeds are covering my sins, right? And he's right. But first, Paul has to convict everybody before he can let them off the hook. Get the picture? So that's the direction I'm going. You were, weren't you?
Actually, they were what I was thinking.
I knew it! Go ahead!
No. I was thinking that we are going to be judged according to our deeds, but not our deeds, Christ's deeds.
There you go.
That's what I was
thinking. Fair enough. So. I got most of it. I felt the brainwave. Okay, so then, there's no respecter of persons with God, Jew or Gentile, either way. Why? Verse 12. For as many as have sinned without the law will perish without the law. As many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law. Then he makes a very particular point. Now, when we got to this point before, when we got to 2:13, this is where we started to kind of veer off into Jewish history, and so I didn't get to kind of talk about this point. If you were raised in Greco-Roman culture, you were raised with Greek philosophy. And anybody who's been to school at all had to spend some time studying philosophy. And if you studied philosophy, you were introduced to Greek philosophers. Greek philosophers kind of fall into two large camps. They were either the Stoics or the Epicureans. Stoics believed that the way to get through this life was to deny yourself all fleshly pleasure. The Epicureans took the exact opposite approach and said, eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die. That the purpose of life and the philosophy of life is live life to its fullest because this is all you get. So those were kind of the two opposing camps. The Stoics kind of held sway in the first century. The Stoics had a lot of philosophical sway in Greco-Roman culture. And one of the things that the real Stoic philosophers argued was that it wasn't enough to just spout Stoic philosophy, which a lot of people did. If you were in the street and you wanted to sound intelligent, you would quote the Stoics. But then the true Stoics, who actually were living in caves and denying themselves and, you know, living more like John the Baptist and not having any of the pleasures of life, would say you're not a true Stoic unless you live it. It's not enough to just spout it. It's not enough to say it and agree with it. You have to actually do it to be a Stoic. Get the picture? It's exactly what Paul does here, is that he picks up that kind of philosophical thinking and very typical Stoic philosophy, which is why it's kind of parenthetical in verse 13, and he says, for not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. In other words, he took that same philosophical statement that they all were familiar with about Stoicism and kind of turned it on its ear against the Jews and said, now look, where the law is concerned, it's the same deal philosophically. It's not good enough for you to just give mental assent to the law is good. And it's not enough to just say, yeah, the law, I agree with the law. You have to actually do the law for the law to be any good for you. If the law is going to be any help to you at all, you have to perform by the law. Now, people who want to be legalists will get a hold of that phrase, not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. And say, well, that proves right there that Paul taught that you could actually be justified before God by keeping the law. That there must be some people somewhere who actually kept the law to the point where they were justified. But if you flip over to like 3:20, he's going to make this emphatic statement concerning the law. Romans 3:20, he said, therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in God's sight. For by the law was the knowledge of sin. So back here when Paul was making his statement back in chapter 2, verse 13, he clearly was not teaching that anyone could be justified by the law. What he was saying was, you Jews who brag about the law, and you Jews who walk around going, well, we have the law, and we're circumcised and have the law, he was saying, that's not going to get you justified. Just simply being Jewish, just simply having the circumcision, and just having the law won't get you in, even though you think it'll get you in. Paul says it's not good enough to just have the law. You would actually have to do the law if justification was going to come to you by the law. Get the picture? Verse 14. Now he's really going to set it on there upside down. He's going to turn it completely on its ear and say, "For when the Gentiles, which don't have the law, do naturally the things contained in the law, then those Gentiles, having not the law, are a law unto themselves." Well, to the Jewish mindset, this was insane. Because only Israel had the law of God. And he, Paul, is making the point, it's all about performance. It's all about what you do or don't do. It's not enough to say, "I agree with the law," if you don't do the law. He said, if you're out there breaking the law, even though you have the law, but a Gentile, naturally, just because he is an internally moral kind of person, does the things contained in the law, then he becomes a law unto himself. And they went, "Oh, no, no, now you're just confusing us, Paul." So he says, "Oh, look, verse 15. Those Gentiles that do the things contained in the law, they show the work of the law written in their hearts, and their conscience is bearing them witness, and their thoughts, the meanwhile, are accusing or excusing one another in the day that God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel." And that's the exact place we stopped when we went rushing back into Hebrew history. His final point here is men are judged on the basis of their conscience and their heart. And I said, I think 7 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, whatever it was, if you believe something is sin, it's sin for you. Once you're convinced that something is sin, it's sin for you. Once you're convicted of it, don't do it. Because God is smart enough to know, if you're smart enough to know, if you have figured it out that it's wrong for you, then certainly God has figured out that it's wrong for you. And then if you do it anyway, you're not just rebelling against your conscience, you're rebelling against God. Because you were convinced that it was wrong before God to do it, but you did it anyway. So he said, now look, even a person without the codified Mosaic law can live according to that kind of rule. And when he's judged on his works, he'll be judged according to that kind of rule, though he doesn't have the law. Now that he's leveled the playing field and said, everybody will be judged on the basis of their works, he's going to turn to the Jews because he knows they're objecting all over the place now. By now, they're furious. By now, they're saying, you've made no distinction between us and them. And look at us. Look at what we got. We got the temple. We got the law. We got the Torah. We got the Ark of the Covenant. We got the stuff. We got Abraham. We've got the covenants. We've got the promises. We've got the circumcision. We've got all this stuff that the Gentiles don't have, and you just equalized us. You just equated the two of us. So Paul answers them. Verse 17. So behold, thou art called a Jew. Okay, so who's he talking to? Let's be real clear here. The Jews. Very good. Very good. He's not talking to Gentiles at this point, and that's going to be important in a few minutes. Although Gentiles would read this and understand his argument with and against the Jews. Behold, thou call thyself a Jew, and you rest in the law, and you make your boast of God. That's exactly what a Jew would do. He would say, I'm a Jew, I have the law, and therefore I boast that I am okay with God on the basis of the fact that I've received the law. Verse 18, and you know God's will, because you have the law. And you do approve the things that are more excellent. In other words, you agree that the law is the better way to act, and you give mental assent to that. Absolutely. And how is it that you know what the better things are? Because you were instructed out of the law. And you are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind and a light to them which are in darkness. You are an instructor of the foolish. You are a teacher of babes. And you have a form of knowledge and of the truth in the law. Now, Israel had a responsibility all the way back to Deuteronomy, that having been given the law, they were to go teach this law. They were, in fact, to do all these things. And Paul has said very positive things here. He's not being cynical. He's not being sarcastic. He's saying, let's take a good look at you. You call yourself a Jew. You make your boast of God. You have the law. You're instructed by the law. You agree with the better things out of the law. As a consequence, you consider yourself that you ought to, given the enlightenment you have, that you ought to go out and be a leader, that you ought to go out and give sight, that you ought to go out and teach people, that you ought to be an instructor in the law because you have the law. He says, these are all good things. That's what you consider yourself to be. They'd agree with every part of this. They'd go, yes, yes, Paul, yes, absolutely. There's the distinction I'm talking about. That's right, Paul. I'm not like them dirty Gentiles who aren't like this. I am like this. Okay? So now he asks rhetorical questions. You're an instructor of the foolish, verse 20, a teacher of babes. You have a form of knowledge and of the truth in the law. So, verse 21, thou therefore which teachest another, shouldn't you teach yourself? Teachest thou not thyself? In other words, okay, now you agree that you ought to be teachers. You agree that you're the ones with the insight. You agree that you're the ones with the law. Let's talk about you then. Shouldn't you also instruct yourself? The answer to the question would be, well, yeah, but he never gives the answer. It's a rhetorical question. Then he accuses them of three things. Thou that teachest that a man should not steal, do you steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, do you commit sacrilege? Now, that has made commentators, those three questions, have just raised all sorts of commentator queries, and I've been reading commentaries this week trying to suss all this out, and I've read six different interpretations, translations, trying to get what he's getting at here. And Douglas Moo makes a great point, which is that he says the fact that he's asked these questions and turned them back on these people, these were the very accusations that the Roman church had been accused of by the Gentile church. That the Jewish church had been accused of doing these very things. So he's asking the question, are these things true? Do you do these things? Because if you do any one of these things, you've broken the law. You're a teacher of the law. You're a guide to the blind. You're an instructor of the foolish. And have you ever broken the law? Because if you have, then you're guilty before the law. The third question that he asked, the first two are pretty obvious. When he says, you that preach that a man shouldn't steal, do you steal? When he says, you say they shouldn't commit adultery, but don't you commit adultery? The third one's really interesting because it says, do you commit sacrilege? Sacrilege isn't the best translation of the Greek term. The Greek term there has to do with robbing temples. The same Greek term he used here was the term that was used when Rome came in and conquered Jerusalem and sacked the temple. Same word. You go in and you steal all the idols and steal the gold out of the temple. And he says, do you rob the temple? Well, now he's getting somewhere, because back in Malachi, which is the end of the Old Testament, written against these very Jews, well, generations ahead of these very Jews, God put the declaration down, you have robbed me. And you will say, wherein have I robbed you? And I will say, in the tithes and the offerings, they've robbed the temple. So Paul's got him dead to rights right there on Malachi. On the other two, he's saying, if you have broken the law in the least, and the two things that he names, stealing and adultery, are two of the Ten Commandments. So watch what he does with this now. Because he doesn't answer these questions, like I said, we have to decide what the answers must be. Paul is obviously assuming that they have done one of these three things. Otherwise, the questions are moot. Having said that, he says, okay then, verse 23, you that boast in the law. When you broke the law, did you dishonor God? When you make your boast of the law through breaking the law, dishonorest thou God? Well, the obvious answer to the question is yes. That if you're going to boast in the law as the means of your justification before God, which is what these Jews did, they said, we're going to be okay because we have the law, and we keep the law, and we're justified by the law, and we're going to go before God on the basis of our works. And Paul says, yeah? Have you ever broken the law in any way? Because if you have, did you dishonor God when you did it? They would have to say, yeah, yeah. Well, then can you be justified before the God you've dishonored? You can't be justified before the very God that you're dishonoring, right? If you're going to be there on the basis of your works. If you want God to judge you on the basis of your works, you better make sure that every single work of yours honors God. Because if he can find any single work that dishonored him, you can't be justified before him. For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written. Now that's interesting. He said, you know what? The Gentiles are out there running around denouncing the God of Israel because of the way you people act. So you have more than just dishonored God. You have caused the name of God to be blasphemed, because while you're walking around saying, we have the law, we live by the law, we have the circumcision, we have Abraham, we're justified by the law, you're also clearly sinning in a way that the Gentiles recognize as sin. And in so doing, you're more than just dishonoring God, you're causing people to blaspheme God and say, I couldn't go to that God of Israel because look, that God of Israel has sinners among his people. That's what these folks were doing. They were walking around judging everybody by the law. You break the law. You are a lawbreaker. You're a sinner. You're a Gentile dog. You're... And then they would turn around and obviously sin. Steal, rob, commit adultery. Steal from the temple. And the Gentiles could say, wait. Where is this God you speak of? Where is this God of Israel who's justifying you when you're clearly sinners just like we are? But that same God lets you sit in judgment on us? And they blaspheme the name of God and walk away. Paul is trying very hard to drive these Jews to desperation. He's trying to show them how desperate their state is, because they think they're okay. They think they're all right. Paul is saying here, you Jews who act like that, who boast in the law and judge other people on the basis of the law, you make obvious that you're not keeping the law either while you're judging other people and give opportunity for the Gentiles to blaspheme God.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If I'm understanding correctly, what you're saying is the Jews live by the law? Is that what you're saying?
The true Jews, not converted Jews, not Christian Jews. Yes, they lived by the law. Their whole society was based on trying to keep the law. They studied the law. So yes, they tried to live by the law. The problem...
So they didn't live by faith?
No. And this is what Paul's... Right. And this is what Paul's going to get to, is that he's going to say, and that's why he's convicting them, that the law isn't going to save them, is he's then going to offer them the real way of salvation by grace through faith. First, he has to show them that they can't be saved the way they think they're going to be saved. Paul is going to say, as he did here, we looked at chapter 3, verse 20, where he said the purpose of the law was to convict people of sin. They thought the purpose of the law was to make them righteous enough to go to heaven. They thought the reason God gave them the law was so that they would eventually become so good that God would accept them and justify them on the basis of the fact that they kept the law as good as they could. So when Jesus came along and said, your righteousness needs to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. The scribes and Pharisees were, if anybody came close to keeping the law, the scribes and Pharisees were as close as it came. And he said, if you're going to be justified before God by the law, you'd have to exceed them. In other words, it's an impossibility. You can't approach God on the basis of, look what I did. So both in Romans and in Galatians, Paul explains to the Jews that the reason God gave the law was because they had become such a sinful, stiff-necked, argumentative, sinful people that God stuck the law on them to make them understand how wrong they were. Here's my standard, and look how far you are from keeping it. You're guilty. So the law was given for the specific purpose, according to Paul, so that sin would be made more obviously sin. And then he's going to go on and say in Galatians that the law was just a schoolmaster. The word he uses, pedagogos, means exactly that. It was just a schoolmaster to take Israel by the hand and guide them to the Messiah. If they understood the law, they would see themselves as guilty before the law. They would see that the sacrifices of all the animals that the law required, the very fact that they had to sacrifice for sin every week, every month, every year, proved that they were sinful. They never reached the point where they went, well, finally, that's paid up. That's enough cows for us. You know, we've killed enough animals now that I'm clean. The very fact that they had to do it every year proved that they were sinful every year. So it should have driven them to the point, and that's what Paul is correcting. He's trying to show them theologically what they missed, was that the law was never given to justify them. The law was given to convict them. The law was there to make them guilty. Does that answer your question? Okay, good. So yeah, there was a huge misunderstanding. The Jews tried very hard to keep the law. Yes. Which, by the way, they should have tried to keep the law. That's all fine and good. They should have lived good lives. They should have kept those commandments. They should have done all that stuff. The problem is, what they didn't get was that they could never be justified before God by doing all that. In other words, chances are, and this is just a guess on my part, chances are you've never killed anyone. Right? Okay. That being the case, that's a good thing you done. Good for you, Christy, never killed anybody. We all in this room approve of your lack of murder. We think this is a good thing. But is it a good enough thing that God would say, well, you deserve heaven forever for having never killed anyone?
I didn't get her a ticket in.
That won't get you a ticket in. Exactly. So there it is. Should they have lived by the law? Yeah, absolutely. Was it good that as a society they tried to live by the law? Yeah, absolutely. Did they abuse the law and use it to judge people and put people down and miss? Absolutely. That's why Jesus confronted the Pharisees and says, look what you've done. Look what you've done with the law. You're so busy trying to keep the minutiae, the detail, but you've neglected the weightier matters of the law, which were justice and truth and right judgment. You neglected all that in favor of making sure that you did every little 10% of every little spice of every little, you know, dividing up the granules and so that you were exactly giving 10% so that you were keeping the law perfectly for the purpose of sitting in judgment on other people. So Paul says, well, that being the case, look, nobody's going to be justified by their works. Nobody's going to be justified by the law. No Gentile without the law is going to be justified by his works. And no Jew with the law is going to be justified by his works. Got it? Which is why he would say, like I said in verse 20, therefore by the deeds of the law there shall no flesh, Jew or Gentile, no flesh will be justified in God's sight. For by the law is the knowledge of sin. The law did not bring the knowledge of how to be righteous. It brought the knowledge that you weren't righteous. Got it? Okay, so, that was a really good question. I'm glad you asked it. So then they're going to jump up and down and say, but we're circumcised, but we're in the Abrahamic covenant, but we're Abraham's seed. Verse 25 of chapter 2, he says, well, circumcision will verily profit you if you also keep the law. It's not enough to just say I'm circumcised. Remember what I told you? Their tradition was if you were circumcised, you were out from under the wrath of God and you couldn't be judged. And he says, well, your circumcision would be of some value to you if you also, in fact, kept the law. But he's already said to them that they hadn't kept the law. So is their circumcision of any value to them? No. They're not going to be able to stand before God and say, you can't condemn me, I was circumcised. God's going to say, yeah, but let's talk about your actions. Get it? Okay.
Like some people saying that being baptized, going back to what you're saying about circumcision,
yes,
saves you.
Yes.
They're just looking for a key to the kingdom without walking the walk.
Yeah.
Can I quote that?
It's on tape.
It's on tape. Christy said, for the folks on tape, said that's the way it is with some people with baptism. They believe that just because they were baptized, they're in. And that's right. There are people who think that just because they made a profession of faith at some point, that because they went to the front of a church and went on a crying jag, that because they made Jesus their Lord and Savior, that they are now guaranteed entrance because they did that thing. To which Mark said, they're just looking for a key to the kingdom without having to walk the walk. And that's exactly right. Everybody wants some cheap way in. Everybody wants some guarantee external to themselves so that they can just live like hell and still go to heaven.
They don't want to face the truth.
They don't want to face the truth. Well,
it's hard to live it.
It is hard to live it. And it's hard to walk around with that constant conviction hanging over your head, that knowledge that God is there and God is watching. Jen's nodding emphatically. The very fact that you come to the realization that God is there, he's watching, he knows that he's right there walking with you and is part and parcel of everything you do, that he is participating in everything you do, that's pressure. Okay, I got God with me, walking around with me, got the Spirit inside me. So if I'm off sinning, I'm causing the Holy Spirit to come along on my little sinful rampage. Not that the Spirit then is a sinner or that the Spirit is less holy, but it grieves the Spirit that it's being brought along with me while I'm doing these things. So there's a lot of pressure involved there to walk the walk. So verse 25 then of chapter 2 said, circumcision verily profits if you keep the law. But if you're a breaker of the law, your circumcision is null and void. It's uncircumcision. It's as if you weren't circumcised. So this whole boast of Abraham, we're circumcised, so we can't be judged. He says, guess what? Break the law in one point, and that circumcision you're resting in is of no value to you whatsoever. No value. That we are the covenant people thing, that doesn't mean that God won't judge you. Therefore, verse 26, therefore, if the uncircumcision, that would be the Gentiles, the ones who were not circumcised, therefore, if the uncircumcision should keep the righteousness of the law, well then, wouldn't the fact that he's uncircumcised be counted as if it were circumcision? He's leveling the playing field here. He's saying, okay, so you're bragging about being circumcised, but guess what? If you don't keep the law, that circumcision, meaningless. Meanwhile, if there's a Gentile who is keeping the law over here, does the fact that he's not circumcised count against him? No, absolutely not. God will count him as if he's circumcised. Circumcised, uncircumcised, God's going to judge you for your works and according to your works. Getting the argument? Very consistently leveling the playing field. Verse 27. And shall not the uncircumcision, which is by nature, in other words, every male is born uncircumcised, shall not the uncircumcision, which is by nature, if it fulfill the law, judge you who by the letter of the law and by circumcision do transgress the law? Oh, well, now he's just going to make him angry. Because his question is this. You Jews who always thought that because you had the law and because you had the circumcision and because you had all of that stuff, you always sat in judgment on the Gentiles and even called them heathen. Because God did not choose them the way they chose us. God didn't elect them the way he elected us. We're the nation of Israel. We have all the stuff. They have the nothing. We will sit in judgment on them. And Paul says, okay, so now, if you don't keep the law, and an uncircumcised heathen does, wouldn't he end up judging you? That's going to make your average Jew just flat out angry now. Now he's gone as far as to level the playing field and then said, a person who is righteous will end up judging you, Jew or Gentile or not. That God is going to reward righteousness and is going to punish unrighteousness, whether you're a Jew or a Gentile or whatever. Circumcised, not circumcised. Now, I got to go back and ask the question. If we get through these next two verses, we're done for today. Because these next two verses have caused all sorts of controversy in the church. So we're going to clear up the controversy here. According to verse 17, who is Paul writing to?
Jews.
He's addressing Jews. He's talking about Jews, right?
Right.
So keep a hold of that. Verse 28, he's now going to say, for the Jewish person, that there is much more to being a Jew than just being circumcised and having the law. That there has to be an inward change of heart. That there has to be an inward love for the things of God. And that there has to be an inward desire to please God and do the things that are pleasing to God to truly fulfill the law. That the law was not just external, do this, don't do that. That to truly fulfill the law and to truly be everything that God designed the Jewish religion to be, that you also had to have an inward love and desire toward God. Get what I'm saying? Go back to Deuteronomy. This is the Deuteronomical law. Deuteronomy 10:17. We'll start there. The book of Deuteronomy is the book of the law. All of the minutiae and details of the law are written in the book of Deuteronomy. And yet, in the middle of all that, there's these two verses that we looked at. In the midst of all this law-keeping, God throws in this very specific emotional appeal. Starting at verse 10:12. And now, Israel, what does the Lord thy God require of thee? But to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul. Now, do you remember when the Pharisees came to Jesus and they were testing him? And they said, which is the greatest commandment? And they were expecting one of the ten. You remember what Jesus said?
He said, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind.
Exactly. Exactly right. Where'd he get that? Right here. He went into Deuteronomy 10:12 for his answer. They were expecting one of the ten commandments and said, what's the greatest command in the law? Give us the big one. Is it stealing, killing, the adultery thing? What's the big one? He went completely aside that and said, well, you'll love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. And then added, and the second one is like it. Remember what it was?
You'll
love your neighbor as yourself. In this, according to Jesus, is all the law and the prophets fulfilled. The whole thing. You want to fulfill all the law and the prophets, he says? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. So, in that context, he then says, here's what the Lord requires of you. To fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you this day, and they are for thy good. Behold, the heaven and the heaven of the heavens is the Lord thy God's. The earth also with all that therein is. Only the Lord had a delight in thy fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to love them, and he chose their seed, that you all after them, even you above all people, as it is this day. In other words, he's saying, yes, Israel, God absolutely chose you above all people. So your reaction should be, what, circumcise? Go circumcise your foreskin? Go, no, verse 16. So circumcise, therefore, the foreskin of your heart, and don't be stiff-necked anymore. So even in the law, even though circumcision was required of the Israelites, even in the law you find this interpretation of circumcision as being the circumcision of your heart. There needs to be an inward change in order to keep this law. In order to love God with all your heart and soul and mind, in order to love your neighbors yourself, in order to even keep his law, in order to do all that, there has to be a change internally that happens to you. There has to be a circumcision of the heart, right? Now, can any man of his own will circumcise his own heart and suddenly love God and keep his commands and do all that stuff? No. Go to Deuteronomy 30. God knew that, so he put this contingency in. Deuteronomy 30. It's just kind of fun to say Deuteronomy. It's one of those words like linoleum or cinnamon or...
Epicurean.
Or Epicurean, yes. I wish I had some Epicurean cinnamon to put on my Deuteronomical linoleum. Say that five times fast. Go ahead. So now, chapter 30 of Deuteronomy says, it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before thee, you shall call them to mind among all the nations, whether the Lord thy God has driven thee. And you shall return unto the Lord thy God, and shall obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children, with all thine heart, with all thine soul. Does that sound familiar? God said, now look, after all the stuff I predicted happens, after you've been scattered, after all the blessings and the cursings have happened, after all that, he's going to return to Israel. We've seen this as a common theme now, haven't we? He's eventually going to bring Israel back together. And when he does, They're going to observe all the things that he commands them and their children, and they will finally love the Lord their God with all their heart and all thy soul. How will that happen? Verse 3, that then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion on thee, and will return and gather thee from all the nations where the Lord thy God has scattered thee. And if any of thine be driven out into the uttermost parts of heaven, from thence the Lord thy God shall gather thee, and from thence he will fetch thee. And the Lord thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed. You shall possess it, and he will do thee good and multiply thee above all thy fathers. And look at what he'll do in verse 6. And the Lord thy God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your seed to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that thou mayest live. So how does it happen? What's the promise to Israel? First, they're commanded, circumcise your hearts and love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. Jesus comes along and says, that's the great command, by the way. Do that. But even in the law, the promise is that God will be the one who will ultimately circumcise their hearts, bring them to himself, and cause them to love the Lord thy God with all their heart, soul, and mind. Get the picture? Which, by the way, is how it happened to you. Go back to Romans and we're done. That's how it happened to you. You were commanded absolutely to have faith and obey God. You were commanded absolutely, just as every member of planet Earth is commanded to obey God, to love God, to have faith. That command is universal. Everybody on Earth is told to respond to God. And everybody will be held guilty for responding or not responding to God. But then some people God entered into. Some people God went in and circumcised your heart. Some people God went in and changed you from the inside, drawing you to himself and causing you to fear and love God. And the promise is that the very same God who did that to you is going to do it one day to Israel. So now, verse 28 of Romans 2 says, for he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter of the law, whose praise is not of men but of God. So what's he saying there? He's saying that a true Jew, a real Jew, a graduated Jew, a person who understands what we just read in the law, understands that it's more than just an outward fleshly keeping of the law, like you asked. It's more than just the outward do this, don't do that. That the true religion God was posing all the way back in Deuteronomy was a religion that loved God from the inside. And from the inside, those works grew outward. That the inward change of heart that only God could cause would then make a person naturally have the outgrowth of good works. And that goes all the way back to the law, all the way back to Deuteronomy. So he says, you Jews who make your boast in the law, and you make your boast in your circumcision, and you have all these outward signs that you're okay. He's saying, look, that's not true Judaism. That's not what a real Jew is. You Jews who boast like that, let me tell you what a real Jew is. A real Jew is one who from the inside has been changed by God. And the outgrowth of that is that he does those things that please God. That's a true Jew. Now, I have to ask the question, because this is so obvious now, can you from those two verses deduce that what Paul is saying there is that a Christian believer is a true Jew? Is he talking about Gentiles at all here?
No.
No. He addressed Jews and he's talking about Jews, right? Has Paul introduced Gentiles into the argument here anywhere? No, but I'll tell you, you know, last week we were talking about how pervasive this false Israelology is out there. That's a jumping off point right there for the people who want to say that the church has replaced Israel and that God is done with Israel. There's no future for Israel. They say, well, right there it says that a believing Christian who's been changed internally, whose heart has been circumcised, is a true Jew. And so if Gentile believers are true Jews, then all those promises in the Old Testament made to the Jews will be fulfilled in the church, the true Jews. Get the logic? Pretty clever, huh? The problem is it starts with the false assumption that Paul anywhere in there was addressing Gentiles. Or that Paul has constructed a theology whereby Gentiles could somehow magically become Jews.
Well, he says he is not a Jew, which is one. And to me, that's indicative of him, or actually referring to where he started, which was he was talking to
Behold, you are called a Jew.
Right.
Absolutely. So that's exactly right, Brent. That's very good.
He that is a Jew is not one. And that's how I read
That's right. No, that's quality biblical exegesis right there. That is letting the word stay consistent with the word. And you're exactly right. Because he starts with, Behold, you are called a Jew. So he's clearly addressing the person who calls himself a Jew. And then he says, you who call yourself a Jew, you're not a Jew that is one outwardly. A true Jew is one inwardly. That's very consistent. But that hasn't stopped the church from coming up with all sorts of errant theology. And I thought as long as we were here, I'd address that. Because you'll bump into it. Pardon me?
I don't see how they read that.
I can see the logic. Because if you pass over, if you're not reading carefully, then you can pass
Forget
over.
The context.
Right. And, and one can easily...
Well, if you're just studying those two and you don't look up at 17 where he's...
That's exactly right.
That's
exactly right.
See,
a lot of the difficulty that I... or let's put it this way. The reason that I don't teach topical studies... where I pick a topic and then I pick and choose verses throughout the Bible that seem to say or support what it is I'm trying to say. I could preach on painting your house blue. I mean, I could say that the Bible teaches that you should paint your house blue and then go look for verses that may or may not support it and then twist those verses to say, there's my support. If you start with the supposition that God is done with Israel because you don't want to do the work in the Old Testament, if you start with the supposition that God's done with Israel and you're going hunting, pecking for verses out of context that make it look like that might be the case. And if I were to say to you, now let me tell you something, God is no longer dealing with Israel, the Jews. God is now looking for a new kind of Jew. God is looking for the true Jew. And then I read this out of context. And Paul even said, because he's not a Jew that is a circumcised Jew. And the Jews were all circumcised, and that's how you knew a Jew, because he was a circumcised Jew. And Paul says he's not a Jew that's one outwardly who's circumcised. But he's one that is one inwardly who has a circumcision of the heart. And if the Holy Spirit is in you, you have the circumcision of the heart, and thereby you are a true Jew. I heard it preached. Heard it preached 2 weeks ago over in Franklin. That is not clear, consistent biblical exegesis, but it's still running rampant through the church. So I just thought long as we were here, I'd correct that. I'm glad that it seems so obvious to all of you. You all just kind of shook your heads in disgust and went, well, that's not right. And you're correct. That's not right. But if you start with the wrong supposition, you go looking for wrong verses. So then now that he has trashed the Jews and leveled the playing field and told them that even they don't understand their own religion, because if they understood their own religion, they would understand what he just said. A true Jew is one that's been changed inwardly. Well, then they would stand up naturally and say, well, then what's the point of being Jewish? I mean, we got all these promises. We've got all these promises of election. We got the Abrahamic thing. We're being circumcised. We have the law. What's the point? And that's how he's going to start chapter 3. Well, then what advantage is there to being a Jew? And that's what we'll pick up next week. Talk about the advantages. See, I was like coming attractions. See, I like revved you up for something. Starting next week, so then what advantage is there to being a Jew?